Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about the program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Visit our archives there and listen to any program you may have missed. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. We will repeat this info at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. And now, Jim Andrews.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of 1 Samuel. We've come now to chapter 29, the continuing narrative of David's conflict with the first king of Israel, Saul, who is determined to rub him out because an evil spirit has come upon Saul. Saul has been rejected by God. He goes in and out of madness, but when he's not completely mad and raving, he is nevertheless jealous and envious and seeing David as a threat to his throne. Already he knows that it has been determined by God that he is rejected and that he is to be supplanted by David. He knows that. And yet he continues to fight against God and pursue David, as David says, like a flea. Everything is all out of proportion. And when somebody is full of envy and jealousy and on the edge of madness, one does not expect a sense of proportion in any of this. Well, David had come to another crisis point in his flight from Saul. David is a person just like we are. He was enormously godly, but he was human. His faith, though real and genuine to the bone, like ours, was sometimes weak and had hairline cracks in it. One of these cracks showed up again. David despaired of his life as Saul continued to hunt him down. He said in chapter 27, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul." I'm paraphrasing it. "I don't see any better plan than for me to get out of the country, out of Israel, and to escape into the hands of the Philistines. I'm caught between two enemies, but at least now the Philistines know, they have enough intelligence to know that I am really considered a treasonous character by Saul, that Saul is my enemy. So I believe that this time around they will show me hospitality." One other time, David in his despair had gone down there and got out with just an inch of his life. He had to fake insanity in order to get himself out of that sticky situation. Now, in a lapse of faith, please don't misunderstand me, David's faith was not torched, but we all have those lapses. And under the pressure of all of this and the mental exhaustion, David did go down to the Philistines and seek refuge there. And this time, it was a different story, and he found it. But it put him in a position where, in order to make it work, he had to do some lying about his activities. Then, in chapter 28, we saw that a war is in the offing between Saul and the Philistines. This is not the first time, but this is shaping up to be a major battle. And Saul's in despair. He wants a word from the Lord, though he has no heart for God. But like people in a foxhole, they often seek God and they pray. Well, in this case, he needed a prophet and he couldn't find one. He tried to use every means available to determine the will of God, but God was not speaking. And finally, in his despair, he seeks out the infamous Witch of Endor. The Witch of Endor ostensibly brings up Samuel, but the fact that she was shocked at what happened shows that this was not her doing, this was God's doing. And the fact that Samuel appeared as an old man shows, of course, since a spirit is neither young nor old, that this was divinely arranged. It was symbolic, Samuel and all of his insignia, so that Saul would recognize him and the Witch of Endor would recognize him for who he was. And he got the bad news. The bad news is that tomorrow about this time he's going to be dead. Well, now we come to chapter 29. The camera now shifts back to David as the Philistines are marshaling their forces. The Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, where the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is in Jezreel. The lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands, in other words, in military formation. And David and his men were still there with the Philistines. He had gone out. He had now been conscripted by his host to battle against his own people. They were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. David was in a lose-lose situation. He could dishonor and disgrace his host by turning against them and fighting for Israel, or he could disgrace his God by fighting with the Philistines. That is where his lapse of faith had put him. But all of a sudden, we see in verse 3 that the commanders of the Philistines were very apprehensive about David's involvement with his 600 in this campaign. They asked the king, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" This, to them, was not a good situation. Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Look, this is David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel. He's been with me all this time, rather these years, hadn't been quite a year. And all this time, I've had every opportunity to develop complete confidence and trust in him. I found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day." That did not satisfy the commanders of the Philistines. They were angry with the king, and they just kind of drew a line in the sand, and they said, "Make this man go back, that he may return to his place where you've assigned him. Do not, under any circumstances, allow him to go down to battle with us, because there's a danger that in battle he'll turncoat on us and become an adversary. What better thing could this man do to make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be the heads of these Philistine men? Look, isn't this David of whom they sing? This is no Mickey Mouse guy you're dealing with here. Do you remember what they said about this man? Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s. Well, Achish was outvoted, though a king. He couldn't lead in battle unless he had his commanders with him. So regretfully, he called David and he told him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright. Your going in and coming out with me and the army have been pleasing in my sight. I want you to know I've found no evil in you from the day of your coming unto this day. The problem is, the commanders of the army do not trust you in battle. You are not pleasing in their sight, so I'm asking you to return, go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." Well, David goes through what I believe is a mock protest, asking, "What have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day that I came before you to this day? What's to prevent me from going and fighting against the enemies of my Lord?" As I say, I believe that has to be a mock protest for good appearances. I can't help but believe that David had to feel very, very relieved at this point. Philistine commanders, unknowingly, were getting David off a serious hook. But Achish answered and said to David, "Look, I know you're pleasing in my sight, like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have spoken. He must not go up with us in battle. I can't fight City Hall. So arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who have come with you, and as soon as you have risen early in the morning, depart." So David did so, he and his men. They departed in the morning, and they returned to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel, where there's going to be a mighty battle, and Saul and Jonathan, the army of Israel, is going to fall before them. Well, in this chapter, we have a great study in all the bad things that can happen when the people of God go dancing with the devil. That is what David, in his lapse of faith, has done here. He's made a great error, and it's only through the mercy and the grace of God, I've said repeatedly, that he gets himself off this hook, or rather the Lord gets him off this hook, because David didn't do this in wickedness, he did it in weakness. Bear in mind that the Philistines, though not only the Philistines, embodied in their day the very epitome of the spirit of the world in opposition to the ways and the work of God and the welfare of his people. In short, the Philistines are more than an ancient and persistent historical enemy of the Israelites. Symbolically, and that's what we've got to get, they represent the world, hostile to God and his interest. And Israel represented God's interest and was, like the church in our day, I'm speaking of the outward church, represented God's chosen vehicle, the message of redemption to the world, and represented, Israel that is, represented a repository of God's light shining in the darkness of the world at that day. It was not only the Philistines that represented that, I repeat, but in their persistent enmity to Israel and their attempts to oppress and suppress the people of God. They were paragons of the power of evil. At bottom, behind the Philistine aggression, was demonic inspiration. Kill God's chosen messenger, in this case Israel, overrun her, dominate her, acculturate her, and you kill the message. And that is what Satan is all about. And he has put in place a world system, of which the Philistines here are simply a microcosm. And he's put in place a worldly spirit that consciously or unconsciously, but very conspicuously, cooperates with that project. So the Philistines are a pawn of the enemy. In David's day, Philistia then was the world personified, and it was the devil's handiest and nearest tool, human tool, to snuff out the religion and the revelation of Israel's God. And it was his tool to rob them of their God-given inheritance, the promised land, and in the process, the enemy intended, to reduce them to the same kind of pagans that the Philistines were. Now, when David's faith temporarily faltered in giving up on God's promise, on God's ability and willingness to continue to protect him in the land, David, get this, without consulting the Lord, without asking for grace to strengthen and to sustain him, in a fit of mental exhaustion, and I would say battle fatigue also, David did a very human thing. That's not to say a good thing, but he did a very human thing, and we can all see ourselves in this mirror. He ran around the Lord, and he invested himself in working out his own salvation. For the second time now, he flies to Philistia for refuge. The first time didn't work out for very long at all. This time around, he reasoned correctly. His presence there would not arouse the same level of suspiciousness on the part of the Philistines. That's because he knew that they now knew that Saul regarded David as his bitterest enemy. And so David shrewdly calculated. But still, shrewdly calculated or not, he's working out his own salvation, you see. He shrewdly calculated that he would be well received by them as a turncoat. This kind of reminds me of what happened in the days of King Asa, 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9, when the southern kingdom was seriously imperiled by the northern kingdom. Asa, who had trusted the Lord so well for so long, in this case, perhaps jaded by power, he had had it so good for so long, had become a little cocky, and he reflected on the threat of Baasha, the northern king, who was attacking him, and he got politically shrewd and smart. He said, oh, I'll go out and hire mercenaries to come in from behind him. That'll put a stop to his projects. Well, he was right. He was right. It actually worked. But then the prophet comes to him and he said, the eye of the Lord runs to and fro throughout the whole earth to find a man whose heart is whole. But you know in what you've done, you've acted foolishly. You think you've acted shrewdly. This worked. You got the effect. But the devil's in the details. Even though you got the outcome you wanted, you won the battle, but you just lost the war. Henceforth, the prophet told Asa, you shall have wars. Oh, that's bad. Well, that's kind of what David gets into here. It worked. Saul quit chasing him. He's over in Philistia. He's worked out a tidy little arrangement with the Philistine king, who thinks he's a great guy and trustworthy. But he put David, as I say, in a position where David had to be less than honest with him about his activities during the day. He's in the business of working out his own salvation and is going to get himself in a lose-lose situation. And we all do the same thing any time we run off the rails of faith and we start building spurs, trying to run the train in a direction that we think will keep it on the tracks. David should have gone to the Lord with this issue. He certainly went to the Lord with so many of his issues. But David is tired, he's worn out, and his judgment is not the best. Someone has pointed out, very sharply, I think, that God is only mentioned twice in this chapter, which is, I think, doubtless a clue to the fact that this foray into Philistia which, as I said, is a symbol of worldly territory and the worldly spirit, was neither a product of divine guidance, nor was it the place of God's approval for David. And worse, it was a place of worldly security, where David is leaning more on his own resourcefulness than on God's provisions and protections. You know, there's a way that seemeth good to a man, but the ways thereof are the ways of death. And we've got to remember that scripture, friends. And we've always got to be careful to bring our issues to the Lord and not get too smart, not get too wise, not think of ourselves too clever. And there's one of the problems, although David had not experienced that, but that is one of the problems for those believers who've had a long string of untrammeled successes, whether they're in a worldly occupation or whether they're a Christian leader or what. When you have that, there is a higher and higher risk that you're going to get cocky. You're going to think yourself too good, too smart, too clever in the ways that you do things. I remember a pastor friend of mine telling me after he'd been in his church for about 30 years that he had begun to think that all the other pastors who had all these problems that he'd heard about for 30 years must be some kind of muck-ups. They just couldn't get it right. And he was kind of proud of his leadership and management skills, that he hadn't had any of that. And then all of a sudden, unexpectedly, it all descended on him and had just ripped his church from north to south. He told me, it sure humbled me. And then I began to realize that I was just like all the rest, and the rest were just like me. We were all human, and we've all got a common enemy, and that is the devil. But you can have that kind of success and think you're better than you are. In any event, David was not there, but David did fall back on his own resourcefulness. What happened was not a good thing. I cannot emphasize enough, however, that God's habit is to be patient and merciful with this error or any other error. It's not because God winks at any of our foolishness at such times, but it's because David's error in judgment here, and get this, David's error in judgment here was not a decision born of rebellion or ingrained wickedness, but David's poor judgment here was a reflection of extreme circumstances and the weakness that goes with those extremities. Folks, our God is compassionate with the godly in spirit, but weak in faith. And therein is a ton of comfort for those of us who truly love Christ, who seek to please God. But nevertheless, in times of great and prolonged stress, when we're not thinking as clearly as we ought, or maybe beaten and battered around trusting as firmly as we should, we make some dumb choices, make some foolish decisions. Our failures, I tell you, are no more final than David's. The Lord will give us a rematch in His time. One of the great lessons that we can learn from David's second experience narrated here in Philistine territory is this. You can make friends in the world, but you can never make a friend of the world. The Lord Jesus Christ never taught us that everybody in the world will hate us. He did say, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before you. But He never taught us that everybody in the world would loathe us. Absolutely not. The fact is, we will meet, work with, play with, enjoy the company of some really choice people measured by merely human standards. People who, although are not believers, in the common grace of God, these folk have elevated ideals, morals, and ethics, and are delightful, engaging, and helpful. They are still of the world, but in the common grace of God, they do not embody the worst of it, though still lost because they, like us, are sinners, and the wages of sin is death. Apart from the atoning blood of Christ, they possess socially redeeming and endearing qualities that you and I learn to love and admire. Their problem still is, however, that while they please us in many ways, they do not, none of us do, please God natively as we are. Like us, they are sinners, lost, alienated from God. The only difference is we have received the Savior. We have applied for and received God's forgiveness through the atoning blood of Christ, but they refuse to humble themselves before God and persist in thinking that they will find life on their own terms. But in its classic spirit, the world is hostile to God and everything He represents. It is an anti-God, pro-self, pro-sin spirit, and anti-Christian mentality. It's Philistine. It loves what is evil, and it hates what is good. It was to that world, that Philistine world, which is a microcosm of the macrocosm, David looks for protection from another enemy of God. But what he soon discovered is that though he found a friend in Achish, the king of Gath, he could not find acceptance with the Philistine community as a whole. They never really trusted him. Do you know why? Because though David was in their world, he had not yet satisfied them. He was of it. He had not yet sold out. I say again, you can make good friends in the world, but you can never make a friend of the world. And we see that little drama played out in the case of David. Some Christians put themselves in a similar dilemma to David. They go over to the Philistines, so to speak, hoping to win them over, only to find, along the way, that they are becoming Philistines. Friends, we will never be at home in this world until we become like the world. Don't deceive yourself. Don't ever think that your charm, your savvy, your talents, your accomplishments, your community spirit will deflect from you the loathing of the world in general. Yes, you may meet some Achishes, but that's not the world. You can make friends in the world, but you can never make a friend of the world. Jesus has already forewarned us against such an illusion. John 15, from which I quoted earlier, the Lord said, look, the world's not going to like you. And when you find out it doesn't, just understand this. They didn't like me either. If they don't like me, they won't like you, because the servant is not going to get any better treatment than his master. The more you're like me, the more you'll get the same treatment from me. No, for all of his wonderful attributes, abilities, and achievements, David made a friend, Achish, but he did not win over the Philistines, and could not, until they were convinced by compelling evidence that he had sold out. Ah, we need to learn this. How many Christians think they can cajole, caress, and lightly con the world into some kind of rapprochement with Christ? It won't happen, friends. Get used to it. Being an academia, I have seen so many scholarly and intellectual types try to go over to Philistine territory for protection from the scandal of Christ. It's the look mall, no hands intellectual approach that tries to impress the world with our academic resume and our intellectual acuities and credentials in the vain thought that they will admire us and perhaps join us. What a foolish enterprise. Note also that David would not even have had a friend in Achish if he hadn't disguised his activities and loyalties, which brings up another lesson. Anytime we find ourselves in a position in Philistia, you know, symbol for the world, where we're forced to deceive, to mince and to dance and to hide our loyalty to Christ, to keep our friends in the world, and to preserve our treasured place in the world, we have, one, become too much like the world, and two, we're looking out for our own interest more than Christ's interest. Well, notice how David, in his faltering faith, put himself in a position where he had to be deceitful to protect himself. I've mentioned that, and those under his charge. In the final analysis, in the grace and mercy of God, the Lord got David out of the pickle that he was in. Fortunately, David, like us all, was a work in progress. He did not make many of these blunders, though later in his life, and jaded a little by his power and success, he did go over the top and brought disgrace on himself and discipline that would dog him to the end of his days. But in this instance, the Lord had compassion and bailed him out. Thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word, remember, is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about this program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at www.thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this broadcast outreach.